Welcome to Understand Suicide, the podcast of journalist and therapist Paola Fontanelli. Since her father's suicide in 2005, Paola has dedicated her life to breaking the silence around this most stigmatized of subjects. Her book, Understanding Suicide, Living with Loss, Paths to Prevention, was nominated for the National Book Award in Brazil, and the English edition is now available on Amazon.
Hello, welcome to my podcast and my YouTube channel. Today we have a guest who is an executive, he's a speaker, but mainly he's a mental health advocate. He's one of those good souls who went through kind of hell in his life, a very tough childhood. He had suicide attempt. He thought about ending his life, but he's here to share his experience. But most of all, and that's what we do here on my podcast, he's going to share with you his message of hope. So where did he find answers? So I'm going to try to say his name right. He just told me how. His name is Kellen Flückiger. Ugh, no, almost. No, I can't say it. Can you say it?
Kellen. It's okay. Kellen Flückiger. Well, glad to be here and thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you so much, Kellen, for saying yes. So I want to start with something that is so common today that we hear about and we talk about, but the way you approach on your book, he's an author. I'll make sure I have all the links. He has many books, but I read only one. And the one that I read was Tightrope of Depression.
Tightrope of Depression.
Yeah, right. And I want to start with that, Kellen, because you said something that I had not thought about, and it really made a lot of sense to me. You said that we do a very good job at pretending we know depression is a disease, but that's not really what happens. Because once you know someone with depression, and that's what you've been through, decades of depression, we start to judge. And we say they're lazy, and you say it's a choice, and you say they have to get out of it, or in many, many, many of the things, you actually write, we pretend that we know that depression is an illness, but then we say they're lazy, they're making excuses, and that's something I'm sure that you went through, because even when you came out, that's what you share in your book, even when you came out with your depression, you had a lot of people judge you and question why you did what you did. So can you talk to my listeners about depression, what it meant to you, what it did to you psychologically, physically, because we know it affects the body, but mainly about the stigma?
Yeah, thanks for doing this. It's really important. One of the things in the just before I, or at the time I released this book back in 2016, Robin Williams near that time had committed suicide. And One of the things that I noticed is that when someone of a high profile, and then there was another high profile artist in Toronto, then all of a sudden we talk about it, it gets up in the front page and we make this noise about mental health advocacy and healing, and we make moves in that direction. And very quickly it slides back under the radar as yesterday's news. And I'm not suggesting that it's more important than any other illness, struggle, or challenge that we face today, but we certainly have a definition of it that's not helpful. If I break my leg and I get a bone sticking out of my leg, it's easy to see. Well, mm-hmm. We got to put that back in there and bandage it up and stuff. And then you're going to be on crutches for a while, and then it's going to be okay. And everybody understands that. Stuff in the mind, whether it's, you know, bipolar, depression, anxiety, all of those things, mm-hmm. You know, you can't see any of that. And because it's in the mind, then we think the solutions are all in the mind, like, well, just be happy, choose to look on the bright side and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
One of the funniest things that got said to me by a doctor in my beginning journey of trying to deal with this after 40 years of never talking to anyone, she said, well, you're a motivational speaker. You can't be depressed. And that was her idea of depression. Like, you know, because you do this thing that helps people be excited, have courage and everything else, you can't have depression. And that was her knowledge. And that was a doctor.
I could write a doctor, Kellen, with only these absurd things that I hear from people I interview, from my patients, of the things that they say. And I'm going, oh my God, really a doctor? Anyway, so you went through that. You went through a lot of lack of compassion, right? People who pretend, as you said, and it's true, it's the same about suicide in a way. When someone who is well known dies by suicide, then it's front page and everybody talks about it, and they usually go to depression because that's the mental illness most closely associated with suicide. But then it just, we forget about it again. Then we go back to our, you know, everyday way of looking at mental illness. And as you said, if it's in the mind, just switch, right? Just switch it off.
Like we chose to do it in the first place, especially when it starts young. Like I was on another interview and someone asked me if children could have depression. And I said, well, I don't know, because I'm not going to pretend I'm a medical expert on it. But what I know is from my earliest teens, when I was 13, I remember seeking refuge in drugs because, and that was not with friends. It wasn't like peer pressure or any of that. It was all alone. I did it all alone because I couldn't stand reality the way it was. And so I don't know when that starts or when, but I remember my first inclinations that I was really looking for a way out of life in terms of how it was relating to me was in my early teens. Mm-hmm. So that was like when I was 13 years old. And it's not difficult for me to postulate or to think why I had that. I was raised in a very, you know, strict home with a lot of discipline. And the discipline that was administered today would be felony child abuse. And, mm-hmm. you know, kids would be removed from the home. It left me with is just the certainty that I was not okay. I was fundamentally flawed. Mm-hmm. I was not good enough and I never would be. And so I believed, I adopted that truth and believed it. And because it was sort of based around religion and right and wrong, not just a grumpy, I mean, my parents stayed married. It was my mom that was mainly the one who did that sort of thing. And my dad was gone most of the time, so he didn't know about most of it. I sort of adopted the idea that I was not good enough and never would be. And because it was around heaven and hell and good and bad, I adopted the idea that, well, my mom, she must be right. And so,
of course, because that's what kids believe, right?
Until I was 53, mm-hmm. for 40 years, I spent my whole adult life trying to get her stamp of approval on my forehead, making all the money I could, getting all the positions mm-hmm. I could, all the things that, you know, you should say, yay.
Yeah, about. You're successful, right? Yeah.
Never happened, never will. She's still alive, but I've made my peace with that finally. But for 40 years, I never talked to a soul. I believed the script that it was in my mind. It was my fault. If anything was wrong, I sucked, and it was up to me to fix it.
Yeah. I remember one of the things that I read on your book. It was an episode, actually, something that happened. You call it, I believe, the picture incident. When you were a kid and your mom looked, there was a family picture and she made some remarks of how flawed you were. I mean, I don't know. Something like, I don't know when you changed. You used to be so innocent, a good boy. Now you're all disobedient, selfish, dishonest, unacceptable. And just went on and on. And from that point on, there was, from what you said, there was like a switch in you. And that was your self-image. And that became true.
It did. She didn't want me to be a musician because musicians were all drank and immoral and everything else. And I became her worst nightmare. But I remember that it was a picture of my sister, my older sister, me and my younger brother. And she had three other kids later, but there were 7 years in between there. And so it was like two groups of three. And this older group of three, it was a very idyllic picture, all made up pretty and everything. And she said that, and I'm sure she wasn't trying to do that. You used to be so obedient and nice. And as soon as you turned, I think she said 8 or 9 or something. I don't remember the number, but you became all this stuff, selfish and all these other things. And what do I know? Right. Okay. I did. I remember another powerful incident. She told me she was mad at me one day. And this is my early teens. Told me, you know, I didn't have the right to call her mother anymore because I was so evil, that kind of thing. And, you know, you tell a kid that's in adolescence, 14 or something, that sort of thing. Like, what do you do with that?
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a friend or a loved one who struggles with suicidal thoughts, ideation, or even previous attempts? If you do, I have some information for you. I know that the situation is scary, and many times we want to do the best we can to help, but we don't know how. Over the course of my 15 years working in this field, I have learned how to address these issues, and that's what I want to share with you. And for that, I have just created an online course that will guide you step by step on how to sit down and have this difficult conversation. The course is called How to Help Suicidal People, and I purposely took a very straightforward approach so that when you finish, you will feel prepared to take action in a safe, non-judgmental, and compassionate way. You will learn about the mental state of a suicidal person, how it impacts the way they view their personal crisis, how to bring hope into the conversation, how to prepare yourself to listen to them, especially when they talk about their emotional pain, how to create a safety plan, how to assess their risk level, and much, much more. The course comes in 6 modules and it's all videos with very simple language and reading materials for quick reference. If you think that this course is for you, click on the link on my notes or go to my website, understandsuicide.com, and click on the course tab. There, you can also watch a free sample and have more information about the course. Thank you. When did you realize, when were you able to call it depression? Because you're saying, oh, I look back and as a teenager, this is what I used to do. But what was the turning point when you realized, wow, this is more than just me feeling sad or afraid or anxious?
I didn't do that until I had the courage to go talk to somebody, till I got over the idea that it was not okay. Because again, part of the upbringing was psychologists, psychiatrists, all those people are evil. They will take you away from God. They will lean on the wisdom of men or something. I don't know, but you can't talk to any of those people. So to answer your question, and it might be a shock, it was my mid-50s.
Wow.
I actually accepted the diagnosis from a number of counselors that I finally began talking to in my early 50s, that mm-hmm. I had been struggling with MDD. Mm-hmm. And one of them thought maybe bipolar stuff, but MDD for decades. So that was the first time I was actually able to say, admit, and understand. And they said that after I spent hours talking about history and all the things that had happened. And one of them said, you know, it's clear to me that until right now, the abuse that you suffered has continued.
Because it was still going on inside of you, right?
Yeah, but what I allowed, when I was grown up, I was married. And at, you know, community things, we did musical stuff and at all receptions and church things and all that sort of thing. So my brother, who was younger than me, got married. And at the reception, our family had put a program together, some musical numbers and, you know, singing and playing and all that kind of stuff. I wasn't allowed to participate because I wasn't worthy. I was allowed to come to the reception and sit in the audience, but I wasn't allowed to participate in the program because I wasn't worthy.
Wow.
And so that kind of thing. And so I accepted all these things and believed that I was not good enough. And because I didn't know any better, I didn't know this was.
Nobody does, Kellen. Nobody does.
Abuse. Yeah. Until some shrink finally said, you know, that is consistent abuse and it's time to be done with that. And that's how I began turning the corner, not to be angry about what anybody did, but to take control of my own life.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, what was the turning point? I mean, what made you decide to search for answers and to turn your life around mainly and to question yourself, actually?
The thing that really turned it around for me is that God, our creator, had other plans.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in 2007 in August. It's 14 years last month. There was a period of time, about 2 weeks, where a bunch of really strange things happened. Mm-hmm. And I'll just tell you the last two of the strange pile. Mm-hmm. And that was on a Friday night in August in 2007. I was holding down a big job. I had 4 teenagers living with me. I was single again for the third time because I didn't know how to be married. I didn't know how to be in a relationship. I was a disaster. I didn't know anything that any of this did anybody. I didn't know anything about anything. All I knew how to do is go make money. Mm-hmm. So I did that and I made money. Anyway, so here I am. Friday night, I'd come home for the weekend or come home that night, and I was getting ready to go on a binge. And in the house, I had a great big TV, big as you could buy at the time. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to turn it on because I wasn't a TV watcher, but I had to have one
because... Of course, because that's...
I have to have...
Status, right? Status.
Yeah, there it is. My status symbol. So I, for some reason, I felt this compelling thing to turn on the TV. I didn't know how. So I asked one of my daughters, who's 16, how do you turn this on? So she turned it on. I sat down to watch TV, and it was a program called Intervention, which I had never heard of. And the protagonist was a high-ranking executive with a cocaine problem. So I thought, okay,
oops.
I watched about 10 minutes and I said, I'm not going to watch this crap. And I turned it off and went and did some other stuff for about a half an hour or 40 minutes or whatever. And then, and I was just getting ready to go out and I felt compelled to turn on the TV again. So I turned it on, this time I knew how. And that program started over in the middle of the hour. And no, I don't have a DVR or a recorder.
Wow.
It wasn't on the schedule.
You really had to watch it.
I'm like, holy crap, I need to watch this. So I watched the program. Mm. It didn't turn out well. They refused the help and all that stuff. And I learned what the program was. I didn't even know what Intervention was because I didn't watch TV. But anyway, so I went to bed. That's the first one. And the second of the two things was after I went to bed. It was about midnight. And during the next 17 hours, I was had an out-of-body experience. I was in what I would describe as hell. All of the things paraded before my eyes that I had done. And I was suffered this more intensely than I can even describe. And then at the end of that time, and I didn't know how, I was just there, I heard a voice and the voice said, it is enough. It all stopped and I opened my eyes and the sun was coming in the window and I was shocked because the window faced west. And I'm like, the sun can't be over there. Right. Except it's 5 p.m. So
not normally.
Wherever it wants to be. Right. And I realized that this was an invitation for me to change. So I got up, I threw away $1,000 worth of stuff that I had, and I went from $3,000 a week. I was making so much money that that was lunch money. $3,000 a week to zero in one day. So that was the end of that. That got me sober. It didn't do anything about the depression, but it started the questioning of, you know what? There is something else to do here, and we're not going down this road anymore.
Wow.
So that was the turning the 2x4. It's like, not anymore. Okay. So that was the start.
Okay. So we here on my show, what I want my listeners, I always want them to learn something about a new path because many of them are struggling like you struggled in your past. And I want you to please share what your path was. So you had this turning point, a moment in your life, and you said, you know, I've had enough. I have to change my life. You were one very successful executive. And because that's what culture tells us success is, money, right? It was all about having the big TV, even though you couldn't turn it on. Right?
Right.
But then you realize, you know, up to now, this is not doing much for me. So what was the path from that point on? One of them you already mentioned, and I would love to hear your experience with that because sometimes you have to try many times, but you started therapy. That's one of the things. What else? What else helped you?
I had to get out of what I was doing. So I quit. I walked away from all the jobs that I had, the contracts. I walked away from ridiculous amounts of money. I quit the job that I had. And I didn't have any idea what I was going to do. What I knew was there's something else to do. So I resigned the positions. And one other thing happened that started me on this path. I couldn't have done it alone. So I was living alone. I had four kids living with me. We weren't getting along. They moved out soon. They were old enough to do that anyway. And so I was alone. Except that wasn't the plan either. And so in the positions that I had, I used to get all kinds of freebies because I was making decisions that involved billions of dollars. So executives of companies would get tickets, and I guess they would have bribed you if you were amenable to that, but I wasn't. You get all kinds of free stuff, right? So I used to get tickets to concerts and box seats to sporting events and all that sort of thing. And I got two tickets to a Yo-Yo Ma event. Yo-Yo Ma, if you know.
Yes, that I love him. Cello player, just so to my listeners, they don't, if they don't.
Yeah, the world's best cello player, electrifying performer, one guy down on the stage with his instrument.
He's amazing.
Anyway, so I got two tickets and I didn't know what to do with the other one because I was single again. And so I always gave it away to somebody. And so I said, to the groups that I manage who likes classical music, and a lady in one of the groups that I do. And I looked at her and I said, have I ever given you anything before? No. Okay, cool. See you there. So that was the end of that. We met at the concert. The tickets were, of course, next to each other. And halfway mm-hmm. through the concert, this was literally before I'd walked away from the jobs, 2 weeks after that other event. So I was stone cold sober for 2 weeks. And I'm sitting in there at this event, and the concert's halfway through. And I had this really strong feeling that resembled what had happened 2 weeks before, that voice, and I will say words in my head, said, you need to marry this woman. And I said, yeah, that's sort of ridiculous. I've been a really bad failure at that. We won't go there, right?
I don't want to go there again. Being there, done that, didn't work.
Yeah, didn't work multiple times. Forget all that. So then backstage, after the concert was over, and they were backstage passes, of course. So we're mm-hmm. backstage, blah, blah, blah. The feeling came back way stronger and then said, comma, and you need to tell her tonight.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I argued like crazy, but you don't win those arguments. So I did, and it went about like you would have expected. Mm-hmm. And then in the next 2 weeks, she had her own set of experiences. I resigned, and when it was clear that she was feeling something really different, even though she completely thought I was out of my mind, I went into her office and I shut the door and I said, you might want to rethink all this, because I just quit. In case you think you're getting into a relationship with somebody I got jacked. She had her own experiences. She walked away. She quit. That was 14 and a half years ago.
And you're still together?
We're still together. Cool. And so that happened too as the beginning of my path. But the most important thing on the path was a determination that I will no longer be a victim. I'm going to do something about this. I'm done letting old stories, old people, I don't know where I got to go. I don't know what I got to do, and I don't know where the road goes, but we're going. That was one. And in divine providence felt to bless me with a companion. And that blessing was the reason I was able to get through this. I could not, Kellen, have done this on my own.
On your own. Yeah. I'm so glad you mentioned that. And there is an approach that I really love. It's called narrative therapy. It's a type of therapy. It's an approach, like a framework. And we talk about reauthoring your life. And that mm-hmm. sounds like that's what you did, right? You get that pen back, throw that notebook away, start it over. So let's find a new narrative for my life and let's build it. And because it has to be you. Nobody can do it for you.
Love it. One of the things that happened before I got seriously into drugs, I wanted to be a musician. My mom didn't mm-hmm. want me to. And this was, now we're backing up 20-year rewind. And so I'd owned a recording studio. And then I got busy enough. The studio was full-time. The job I had was full-time. And I had to choose. And being a musician was not okay because I would be a bad person. So I closed the studio, sort of paved over the foundation in the first floor of my life and built everything on the second floor up. And when you do that, eventually it all crumbles. That's sort of what happened when it got to the suicide attempts and all the rest. So I had to take back my creative side. I had to walk away from the profession. It didn't matter how successful I was. I hated it. The money was a decoration. So
money was a symptom, right?
It was. It was all sought for the reasons of trying to get somebody to tell me I was okay. I didn't even care about how many things I had.
Yeah. Sounds like a huge change in your life. You also talk about two things. One is refusing to acknowledge a problem. You have to acknowledge it, right? And it sounds like you did that. So, okay, I have a problem. I need to change this. But the other thing that you mentioned, and it's a topic that I bring up many times in my episodes, is experiencing emotion is essential. Tell me a little bit about that.
Thank you for saying that. I remember in the throes of the addictions and depression, I would say out loud to myself, I don't feel anything. I can be whoever you want me to be. I can be anything, and I can do it convincingly. I had learned to be literally a pathological liar. I could do anything, remember everything, and be anything you want. But me, I don't even know who I am or what I feel. Mm-hmm. I'll just be whatever I need to be in the situation and do it so that you're happy and it's all tuned up and who cares what I'm doing, and I'll just go home and get wasted.
Mm-hmm.
And that not feeling anything was one of the biggest changes to learn. And that wasn't sudden, like ending the addiction was sudden, but learning to feel, learning to be okay with feeling, learning to explore them and not hide from them. That was all huge.
But it takes time, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Yes, and especially, Kellen, because you're a man, right? And what does society say to men?
Yeah, I know. That's one of the reasons I allow myself very much to be emotional. I don't hesitate. If I'm working with clients as a coach, there are times when there's emotion, mine for mine or them. It's okay. I encourage it. I live it. I love it. I feel it. It's true. It's part of who we are. And particularly for men, because it's not okay to need something. It's not okay to talk to anybody. It's not okay to feel or express emotion and all that stuff. And that's all not true. And it's part of the contribution to this mess.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask about your relationships? Did it change? You mentioned your kids a few times, but it sounds like it was a very conflicting relationship, right? They left and you didn't have a good relationship. Doesn't sound like it. Did it change? I mean, the fact that you have changed, have you been able to repair some of these relationships?
A few. I have 10 kids that are all mine, mm-hmm. and some of them still don't talk to me.
Uh-huh.
Some do. And that used to really bother me. I blame myself and the whole cycle of my depression. Everything was my uh-huh. fault. Mm-hmm. That's all gone. I have time. I have hope. And I have infinite patience, which I didn't used to have at all. Mm-hmm. And so I have, yes, some of them are repaired and good. Some of them come in and out. A couple of them, the two that were the children of the oldest mom, mm-hmm. I had a really good relationship with both of them. And then their biological mother died. And that was 2 or 3 years ago. And that's been a real problem for them. They have revisited the fact that they were angry at mm-hmm. me for leaving her ever.
Yeah.
And so that's
part of their grief, right?
Yeah. But the answer is yes, I have. And I have every confidence that given time, patience, and love, that the rest or most of the rest eventually will be okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to end by talking about forgiveness. This is a topic that comes back to my podcast many, many times. And I often think, because I treat a lot of, you know, patients with horrific trauma, and it's tough for me sometimes to talk about forgiveness, because I hear these stories. And sometimes what I find that society again does to the victims is to put again this shame on them that they're not able to forgive, as if it were up to them. Not only were they the victims of abuse, but now you put this weight on them that if you don't forgive, then there is something wrong with you. And I'm going to read what you wrote about forgiveness, and it has to do with your relationship with your mother. You say, if I lose a leg in such an accident, the leg is gone, no matter what. Forgiving the perpetrator means I no longer hold bitterness, anger, and resentment towards that person, but it doesn't change the fact that I am without a leg for the rest of my life. So I like that kind of a definition of forgiveness is. It doesn't mean necessarily that, first of all, it's not for everyone. Second of all, it doesn't mean that you're going to keep relating to that person, right? But it's something that for some people, it is necessary. How did that come around in your life, forgiveness?
There's two parts to it. One is, I call the one thing shaping. Things that happen to you shape who you are. If you choose to forgive someone and no longer hold bitterness against them, that's a separate event than managing the shaping that happened in your life. Mm-hmm. So the leg missing or the depression that I dealt with for 40 years. My mom was really young when she got married. She didn't know how to be a mom. She did all kinds of unkind, mean, brutal things. Okay, fine. That doesn't change. And I cannot be mad at her and believe with all my heart she was doing the best she could or not. That doesn't have anything to do with me managing the shaping, which was the longstanding depression and feeling like I wasn't good enough, which I have to do. So understanding the separateness of those things and not tying forgiveness to excusing. I think some people often it's the idea that if I forgive them, then it's like I made what they did okay. And that's nonsense. Mm-hmm. It's not okay. It never was okay. Forgiveness is a gift you give yourself. because mm-hmm. as long as I carry this rock, I'm carrying mm-hmm. this rock. Mm-hmm. And so whether they ever change or they ask for it or they're worthy of it or desired or anything else, I don't need to worry about that. Mm-hmm. I need to make a choice whether or not I want to keep carrying this rock. I'm never going to be able to, quote, extract justice. That belongs to some other realm. I don't get to do that, and I don't need to do that. If the law is involved, that should take whatever place it takes. And if there's a, you know, God and righteousness and judgment, okay, fine, that's out of my, over my pay grade. But mm-hmm. I'm not carrying this rock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I look at forgiveness as a gift to yourself, even if it's forgiving yourself. So for me, I did all kinds of things that I can't believe I did, the way I treated people in my relationships and how many times mm-hmm. I lied and all the different things during drugs and all that stuff that happens. If I carry that, it gets in the way of my ability to do anything good
mm-hmm. yeah.
because I still carry the rock. I need to give myself mm-hmm. the gift of forgiveness for them and mm-hmm. for me so mm-hmm. that I can show up and do what I have the opportunity to do.
Yeah. I heard the other day someone talk about forgiveness, and the way she talks about it really resonated with me. She said, you know, when you don't forgive, when you hold resentment and anger and you stay in that place, it's like you're drinking, every day you're drinking poison, expecting somebody else to die, waiting yeah. for somebody else to die, but you're drinking the poison yourself.
I totally agree. That rock creates neurotransmitter chemistry in your body, mm-hmm. kills you.
It kills you over time, yeah.
Yeah, physically, it wrecks your system, your body.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a gift you give yourself.
Well, Callan, thank you for your gift. And can you tell my listeners where to find you? Because I know you're a coach and you do this work
yeah,
of repairing life.
Yeah, so I'm easy to find. All you have to do is spell my name right.
Yeah, that's not easy, believe me. You have to spell it.
Amazon. I have 13 books are on Amazon. I have all kinds of music. It's on Amazon. If you look me up on Google, there's thousands of references because of my executive career. There are only two Kellen Flukigers in the world out of 8 billion. The other one is my son. So It's not hard to find me. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Amazon. I'm in Google. I have a website. It's No surprise, KellenFlukiger.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not hard to find.
I'm sure that was a very easy domain to find free. Who wants Kellen Flukiger?
yeah. Nobody else has that.
Thank you, Kellen. Have a good day. And thank you so much for being here with us and sharing
thank
your
you.
Story.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to Understand Suicide, the podcast of journalist and therapist Paola Fontanelli. If you've been touched by suicide and believe your story might help others, please consider contacting Paola through her website, understandsuicide.com.